we only have four lectures left with new material. We have this week we have the last lecture on structure-based models of retrieval. On Wednesday we have a lecture on multimedia and mobile retrieval. Next Monday and Wednesday we have two lectures on essentially applied natural language processing topics. The following Monday, the 7th of December, is Alumni Day, and we have this great suite of alumni coming back to talk about their jobs and sort of the 202 stuff that they're doing for a living. On Wednesday the 9th, we'll have a review day for the last day of the class, and then the final exam will be on Monday the 14th, followed by our annual first-year class wine tasting. Okay. Today I'm going to talk about three things, essentially information retrieval and the document type spectrum, to help position the structure-based retrieval stuff with respect to primarily relational databases. I'm going to spend most of the lecture talking about XPath and XML queries to see how the use of the structure in documents can give us a great more precision in finding the relevant parts of documents. And finally, we'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges that raises for retrieval, because in as on all things, the more benefit you get, the more work you have to do. So as you saw in the Manning book, there's a lot of tricky things you have to do to make structure-based retrieval work beyond sort of vanilla-based bag of words models. So, as I said, we want structure-based retrieval because documents aren't bags of words. Documents have a great deal of internal structure, and they also have a great deal of encoding of the content type that may be at the level of different types of content at the paragraph level, or maybe within a paragraph at the data item level, you know, something about this data type. But most IR models, at least what we've seen so far, don't use any of that. They use document-level statistics about terms, or more precisely about stems or rooted terms. And that's where there can be great benefit of using information about what is inside of a document. And that's where XML can play a huge role, because XML will let us encode the document internal structure. And we can use that to make our retrieval much more effective. Let me remind you of this picture, the document type spectrum. I think I've shown you this in three or four different lectures in different contexts. In this picture, I remember showing you that there were these, based on the kind of document it was, you had different kinds of information management problems. On the far left, where we had unstructured narrative type, or even pre-narrative in the sense that it was tacit knowledge, we had the problems of knowledge management. In the middle, where we have these hybrid document types, we have the traditional problems of content management, things like the granularity of the object we're going to store, which metadata we need to put on it, and so on. And as we move to the transactional end of the spectrum, we have more traditional data management problems, where we have fine-grained document models, where we have not just a fine-grained structure, but we also have fine-grained data typing. So if we, again, reminding you of different types of documents that fall on the spectrum, we have the kind of story-like narrative document type on one end, where we have novels, reports, brochures, academic papers of various kinds. In the middle, we have what I'm calling hybrids, where you have this mixture of data and text sort of stuff, where you have catalogs, dictionaries, patents, encyclopedias, so on, textbooks perhaps. And then at the transactional end, you have orders, invoices, so on, transcripts, things where you have very much a lot of maybe repetition of the same kind of structure, so you really have a lot more to work with. And if you go into a business, and I want to say business in quotes because I want to keep emphasizing that a business to me means some purposeful enterprise that wants to keep doing what it does, so we can get things like governments and schools and nonprofits and the Girl Scouts all can fall into the category of business for this description. Have they managed information? They create, they exchange, they process information. And what they have comes from all parts of the spectrum, but the proportions reflect the kind of business it is. So businesses which are sell a lot of stuff will have a lot of transactional documents. document information. Enterprises which think a lot will have a lot of more policy or white paper kind of things and so on. Governments will issue a lot of laws and regulations and so on. So you see different kinds of document types that characterize the nature of the information work that the enterprise has. Most businesses have a lot of hybrid and transactional types and narrative types. If you look at that list that we had, things like brochures or catalogs and so on, reports, are often precursors of or derivatives of the other kind. So you may have a requirements document which will then turn into an engineering specification as it gets refined so you can actually build something. Okay? You may have a high-level position paper that turned into a policy document that gets turned into a regulation. Likewise, you could have reports which say, this is how we did this month, which is kind of a roll-up and interpretation of the transactional documents of the orders and invoices themselves. So there are these compositional and derivational relationships among document types, and that's really important to get a sense of as you look in an organization. I mean, many of you have done some of this kind of document ethnography, following documents around, and it's really enlightening because you understand the nature of the business as you see its information created and consumed. Let's start with the narrative document type, because they do have structure, just not the kind that is as immediately usable by information retrieval systems. They may have metadata. In fact, that's probably what they mostly have in terms of structure. They'll have some things like Dublin Core metadata, the title, the author, the date of publication, someone attached to this object. They may also have some presentational structure like chapter, section, and so on. But they rarely have internal structures that makes content type distinctions. Can any of that be any help in guiding information retrieval? Those three kinds of structures? You have metadata, you have presentational structure, and then you have, and that's what you basically have. Can that be a use in an information retrieval system? The first two kinds of stuff. Julian.
Some parts of the structure could be like more important than others when it comes to retrieval, maybe abstract or title. You could intuitively think that they are more important than raw text.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you have in content management, often what we have is we'll use the metadata and we'll just store everything else as kind of a text blob. But we'll use the metadata to say, find all the articles written by Bob. And then we get this blob back as the article by Bob. We also could use the presentational structure, like chapter, sections, abstract, and so on, to guide how we decide to chunk the big document into pieces for separate indexing. They're still going to be treated as blobs, in a sense, with no internal structure, but we can then use that higher-order presentational structure to say, let's index the chapter separately, to give us a more precise unit of retrieval. So while it's not being used during retrieval, it's being used, in a sense, during pre-processing. We talked about that in a lecture a few weeks ago about all the things in the pre-processing steps of it to get a document ready to be into an IR system. Sort of knowing how to break it up is one of those things that's important, because if you have a 1,000-page document and you retrieve it, that's not nearly as useful as retrieving a 10-page document. So if it happens to be 100 10-page sections, you're better off using that section structure as the indexing unit. That make sense, Dan? Okay. Okay. I like the Manning book because even after having been, you know, so deeply technical about so many subjects, it used Shakespeare as an example to show this. And I'm calling it the exception that proves the rule, where, you know, most narrative document types really don't have this internal structure, but certainly a theatrical play is a narrative document type, and yet it has highly conventional internal structure. And these can be used to increase precision, as you saw in the Manning book. So you have this need to sort of impose and use more structure when you talk about something like a play. So here you see the markup for this hunk of Macbeth. You have the act, the scene, and the title, and then the verses in the Shakespeare play. Are there any other document types that are highly narrative which have really important internal presentational or structure of some kind? We have to preserve it in an IR system. A law is one where you kind of have to keep track of. You can't just sort of run all the text together. You have to keep like line numbers. Okay, poetry the same way, right? Where you say there may be maybe a bunch of text, but there may be markers on the text which are important in its use. Like this is you know line 120. You have to refer to things by line number. Often you'll find in government or legal documents, because of that reason, every little sentence will have some little will have some crazy little identifier on it. I mean, Amy's nodding her head because she knows that these military specs she sees will have, every paragraph will have a number on it. It won't mean anything, but it'll be section this, and the next one after this will be 1.1.12.45.D. Right? It's not like that's a hierarchical content model that says this is part two of this. They're just giving an identifier because they know they want to be able to go back and separately change it, perhaps. And often in this case, we'll have, in a regulation, you'll have revisions would say change this particular sentence in the regulation. So you've got to be able to say uniquely to be able to uniquely identify that point in the document.
Is this for retrieval purposes or reproduction?
Maybe for a little bit of both. I mean, you want to be able to reproduce the document. In fact, there may be strong legal requirements to reproduce the document exactly as it was entered. So the ability to maintain what is called presentational fidelity, I think it's called. Yes. Professor Haas, yes.
I know in my environment, we mostly use it for citing things. You know, even in emails, we say, in accordance with 1.1, blah, 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 blah.
Like that, traceability. I'm saying this because I can point to some line in some CFR, right? Sorry, Code of Federal Regulations. Is that what you cite to typically, CFR, or what else? Or some kind of mil-spec 3247-A?
Manual, yeah.
Manual, yeah, right, exactly. The Bible, great example. Great example. We give things numbers. John 3.16, right? Good example. Make a note, that's a great example. All right. Okay. So, you know, this idea, again, from Manning, that there's a lot of hierarchical structure we should use, jumps out at you when you look at the play. You go, duh. Here you see this play. It's got a root element. It's got metadata like author and so on. It's got elements like act, which have sub-elements like scene, which have sub-elements like verse. Surely this should be useful to us if we're trying to retrieve Macbeth. And so we want to use this structure somehow to increase the precision of retrieval, to find the smallest relevant unit. And of course, that means you've got to find a way to index that unit in a way which preserves that level of granularity. Let's move on to this hybrid document type in the middle of the document type spectrum. These are often called semi-structured because they're more structured than narrative and less structured than structured transactional documents, duh. Okay? They have some regularity in data content than pure narrative types, which can be written any old way. I mean, we want to encourage different love stories. You don't want to have all of them be the same. Okay? Whereas we kind of want to have all of our catalog items and encyclopedia articles have the same kind of structure, because it's useful to be able to have that predictability about, I'm sure there's a set of key terms in this entry. I'm sure there's a set of cross-references in this entry. I'm sure there's a set of, you know, chemical compounds called out in this chemical encyclopedia. So the key question there becomes, how much of that structure should we explicitly mark or tag in the document? Because, you know, in a chemical textbook, we talk about chemistry, we talk about chemicals, we talk about, you know, reaction, talk about procedures and so on. Is that going to be just in the text as text, or we can actually put internal markup to capture that? So, you know, the question is, in a XML document where we can actually give type names using elements, name the type of content, we can have things like note, warning, instructions, question, answer, code example, illustration, caption, map, definition, all those we could have in our document as tags, element names, to wrap around some hunk of text that says, this is what the kind of content that is. We can even do that to a limited extent in HTML, right? How do we do that in HTML? There's a word here I'm looking for. How do you mark up certain kinds of specialized types of content in HTML? Microformats. See? Something did stick from a month ago. Isn't that a great feeling that something actually is still in there? Alright. Okay. We may also have within a paragraph, so even within one of those paragraphs that we've tagged as a calendar entry or a note or a warning or whatever it is, we may have other internal structure which I call semantic nuggets. That's not a technical term, that's a Bob term. But the idea is that there may be some important pieces of content within a text paragraph that you want to identify as especially valuable. So you may have things like a company name, a product name, a trademark, a person, a proper name. We will say, in a body of text, we'll mark up this. It may be just a text paragraph, but there'll be little nuggets tagged with special things. As so this is a proper name, this is the location, this is the chemical compound. That's what's called in XML. Somebody knows. Who's in XML class? Someone's in XML from Eric Vila. Who's taking XML from Eric Vila? No one wants to commit to this. Okay. It's called mixed content. Right? Mixed content means that you have some running blob of text. You'll have, and we'll see some of this in a minute. You'll have these little content nuggets marked up separately. So you may have something like it could be para, but it may say location, Berkeley. So we can then say find all the information about Berkeley. We can then use this tag to find that paragraph. Yes?
It reminds me of those microformats which provided some like semantic nuggets.
Right. Microformats can do that. We're saying within a blob of para, we can have little nuggets that say this is a something that's more special than just regular PC data. Unparsed character data. It was a long time since you read about XML, I know, but maybe some of it's still in there. Okay. So this extent to which you are going to preserve, I'm going to create and then preserve that internal structure is the essential trade-off we talked about all semester. George. You just waving at me?
Oh, my wrist
is sore. Oh, your wrist is sore.
Yeah.
Hoops this weekend?
No.
5,000 free throws at the gym? No. What?
No, something biking.
Biking? Yeah. All right. So let's look at one of these examples. I mean, when you wait, like, this is like a kind of cool way to be called on it. All right. That's looked at me, George. You're going like this. You don't want to be obvious. You want to go. All right. Okay. Okay. So the question will come down to how much of that stuff is going to be useful to you? Is it going to be worth the effort to tag every single proper name in your document, every single location name in your document? To a certain extent, that can be done by natural language processing technology. If you have a dictionary, say, whatever you see, just tag it. Okay? And we'll see some of that next week or the week after next. I'll give you an example. Here you see some web page I stole someplace, maybe from somebody else's slides, but I like the example. This is a directory of some kind of some university. Looks like, what's 413? What's area code 413? It's what? Oh, UMass. Okay, so that's the middle of Massachusetts. Thank you. All right. Some of you from that part of the neighborhood, right? Some of you from there, right? I think. Some of you from central Massachusetts? Nobody? Okay. Are you guys just acting lay and low today? Is that what it is? The usual passion of this class, I mean, it's only one-sided today. It's asymmetric. Come on, I want some more. All right. So, let's look at this paragraph. This little thing which is in the shaded area here. How many separate pieces of structured content is there in that paragraph? Look at what it says. It says, professor, and then a bunch of topics. And this looks like some kind of link to a home page, and this looks like some kind of, maybe that's a phone number and a directory. No, that's not it. Some kind of other information, whatever it is. So, is that just a blob of text? It could be a blob of text, but I hope it isn't. It presumably looks like it's something which has got internal structure, like the person's academic rank, followed by some set of topics that that person is interested in. So we could encode this in XML in a blob called More Info, where we have the sort of very precise metadata in the first part of this document. Then we have this blob called More Info, where it says Professor, Computational Neuroscience, and so on. And that may be just fine for making things like this directory page. If that's the only purpose for this thing, that's fine. But this gives us this kind of a blobby thing there, where we have this mixed content, where there's different kinds of content in the same place, in the same element. And we don't want to do that if we can avoid it. So maybe we want to have something like this, where we are going to, in fact, exploit that internal structure with tags inside of More Info. Here we have a rank, which says professor. Then we have an interest container that gives us the handle on all the separately tagged interests. It looks like a small nuance, but it might make a big difference in what we can get out of that. But this is, the essential choice that we make as modelers. And I want to talk a little bit about Sylvia's choice. Apologies to Meryl Streep here, but Sylvia was a really, really cool thing about 4 years ago. It was done by a couple of my graduate students, worked with me as research assistant, then a master's project, Carolyn Craycraft and Lisa Delarius Hyman. Carolyn's coming back on Alumni Day, and maybe Lisa is too. Carolyn works for a consulting firm, and Lisa works for Recommind. Some of you might have met her at the job fair. So this is Sylvia. All right? Okay, here's Sylvia. Sylvia is a structured syllabus viewer. So, you know, this is the course as you normally know it, right? But you know what? Let's only look at the quick view. Titles only. Now, let's look at the complete view. Every last bit of structure and so on. But what's even better is that if every syllabus has the same data model, that is, every professor goes to the trouble of having the same way of thinking about what a syllabus is, I can say, you know what? I'm taking 202, I'm taking 210, and I'm taking 242, and what am I doing here? There's this week's reading for those three classes now brought together. Okay? You get the idea? So I'm able to essentially aggregate all my reading assignments and all my other work in one place, one aggregated view of syllabus. Really cool. Students love this. Do we have it right now on campus? No. Why not? Does anyone know why this isn't used anymore on school? Why is this not used?
Well, maybe because like the trade-off between information organization isn't enough for professors to actually go and use this format?
Yes. If you can't spell XML, this is too hard to do. Okay? And here's why. What's really going on in Sylvia? Obviously, to make that work, you have to have a pretty detailed data model about a lot of stuff. Because you can search that. You can say, all the articles by Dumais. Boom, and they can pop up. Is that great or not? Okay? But do we want to encode... You know, again, to think of the kind of precision which you can imagine having in your syllabus, you want to have readings tagged as blob or reading tag very precisely, so you can then do things like suck them into your bibliography file, and you know, you can do all that bibliographic infrastructure many of you know about from when you buy papers and stuff, you know, bib notes and all those kind of things. Use a standard data format for that. You can have this nice interoperability between syllabus and your writing project and so on. But they struggled a long time with it. They went to every professor in, here's their, by the way, their final report here, which is quite interesting. The Sylvia Home, okay. So there is the Sylvia Project. This is a very detailed master's report project in the web. You can find it. And in this syllabus project, they did a great deal of... Oh, that's not what I wanted. Sorry. They did a great deal of data modeling to understand the requirements for this application. They looked at like every single syllabus in the school, and they analyzed them and said, what do we need to have to make sure that every professor can say, my syllabus won't work in your application? So they built this very complicated data model that could be a superset of everybody's syllabus that they could have to be able, they could use it, it would not have to, they could pre-produce their syllabus exactly without having to change their logical model. But it turned out that it became too hard to use, because while they did a great job in the viewer, they didn't finish their editor. They wanted to have an editor that would be hide the XML, and the process of doing that was there's their design, how to add information, how to add the teaching team, how to add a lecture, and so on. Great deal of work to design this editor application, but they never finished it. So, without an editor for creating that complicated XML instance, the people who used this new syllabus were me and Eric Vilda, for the obvious reason, we could do XML with our own editors. So for 2 years, I flogged other people, and I bribed TAs of other courses to create Sylvia instances, and then I just gave up, because it's too complicated to do this extra level of work. So the solution is either to simplify the model or to finish the editor that would let you have a Sylvia editor. But both were tried and neither succeeded because of the lack of effort that was put into them. They never quite put enough energy into fixing this problem. So Sylvia died. Let's look at the transactional end of the spectrum now. This is where you have complete structural regularity. You have very prescriptive document models in the sense that there's even not even a notion of a database entry unless you have a database schema. So you have probably a very precise document model here. Often it's because the information is being created by some automated process. An invoice is being produced by an ERP system, not by some person with a piece of paper. So it's regularly produced, regularly consumed. Every piece of information is fully marked up and delimited, so it's separately retrievable. So we have an instance like this UBL fragment of an invoice where you see lots of internal granularity about this. You have things like, even the currency, it says the currency of this transaction is 32.50, but there's a currency code identifying the fact that it's United States dollars and so on. No blobby content. It's all highly structured. So how does this affect information retrieval? Well, it affects it in pretty obvious ways. If you have a narrative document type, all you have is kind of unstructured or weakly structured text content, you have to use full text retrieval. It's the only choice you have. Likewise, if you have a very highly structured content, maybe database retrieval is the appropriate model, where you put things into a database using the relational model to shred every bit of information into a set of tables. In the middle is where it gets interesting for us, and that's where we have structure-based retrieval, where you have the kind of things we're talking about in today's lecture and in the Manning and Barrett readings. Let's begin with the relational side. How many of you have taken or are taking a database course? So most of you know a little bit or more about databases. Again, databases traditionally model information using relations or tables. And if you have stuff which can be put into a table, then you can put it in a relational database. Now, we often want to get things out of relational databases to publish them, to create create a web page, perhaps, or to hand it off to some other application so the ERP system can hand it to some accounting system. And we often use XML as the interchange format for that. I recall a lecture about interchange formats and interoperability about 39 years ago, about lecture 10 or 12 or something like that. Remember that one about automotive supply chains and all that stuff? Okay. And we can take ordinary stuff at the same time, the stuff which is not a transaction, we can put it in a database by using its metadata in tables and then having either a pointer to some external blob or storing it as a blob in a large blob data field. That, of course, doesn't use any of the internal structure of the document. When you do that, just use this metadata. So you may have a system which says, I store things by author, title, publication date, then there's this blob or pointer to the thing as a complete entity. If you have XML, we can put it in the database one way or the other. We can use a text data type and just shove the entire document into the database as a text object. Again, that would make the XML-ness of no use to the IR process. It's possible to take the XML document and kind of shred it into what's called the tree table, which I'll show you in a minute, where you treat the structure as content. Now, let me just jump ahead and you'll see. So here you see a tree table where we have the XML fragment on the right with A contains B and C, B has text content, C has an attribute content, the tree representation of that document on the left, and you have a table here which sort of says, okay, I'm going to store in my table some elements that have IDs, that have type, and that have values. And I can also have some notion of the structure. So I can reproduce that document on the way out. I can retrieve it and put it back together in its original structure. But it's kind of kludgy, as you can see. It's not a very efficient way to store XML. And a better way is to say, well, XML is a data type. So let me store what amounts to the XML structure in a persistent way, where I essentially have the entire tree already parsed in memory, in the database. Okay? Now, there are actually now XML-aware databases, which are designed to treat XML as a first-class data type. And that decomposes XML into tables in ways that really exploit the XML. The problem there, though, is that, of course, a lot of things in XML, in an unlimited XML world, data modeling world, are more complex than things that relational databases like. Relational databases like a set of tables, they don't like hierarchy very well. They don't like repeated elements very well. They don't like choice elements well. They don't like mixed content. They don't like links. So we kind of force it in if we think like a relational database person when we're designing our XML, but then we're saying we're not using the hierarchical or other kinds of features in XML that make XML XML. So what I'm mostly concerned about, most of what we're going to show you, most of what the book talks about, and most of what people have when they talk about XML retrieval, is using an XML aware database that treats XML as a first-class citizen who can use the XML structures to improve precision. So to do that, I have to show you XPath. How many of you know what XPath is? XPath is the coolest thing ever invented. It's right up there with, like, you know, vanilla ice cream and good vodka. It really is. All right. So XML is a sort of standard way to address parts of XML documents. It essentially says that you can look at a tree, an XML representation, and sort of move around this tree of information in structured ways. So we want to think of this node tree. XML is encoded in this document object modeler node tree, and we can use the relationships between parts of that tree in direct ways. So there's essentially a set of primitive relations that XPath has built in that let it operate on trees in a really, really cool way. It's like, think of it as, how do I walk through this tree? So, this node tree basically says there is an XML document represented with different types of nodes that correspond to different types of stuff, like the elements, the attributes, and the text. And there are 13 different ways of describing the perspective from one node with respect to the rest of the tree, different ways of following the relationships in the tree. So you're looking at the tree and working with it. Now the default way is saying, when I'm in a tree, the thing I'm looking at is my child, my child nodes. But there's more complicated ways, and as I'll show you in a minute, they're very useful. So here you see, again, back to our Hamlet fragment, we have a tree, and we have encoded, we've simplified this a little bit, but the idea is that you can have different parts of this tree you want to get to and then look at its content, let's say, or the relationship between it and other parts of the tree. So we have these notions of a thing called the node axes. Think of it as different directions of walking through the tree. Now, I have this metaphor. I think of it as a monkey in a tree. And I'm in this tree, standing against some branch, I'm going, where can I jump to next? Can I jump to the node directly above me, my parent, the node directly below me, my children, or can I look at the node directly to my side, my siblings? So hopping around this tree, you know, picking the fruit or swinging from the branch or whatever I'm doing, but I'm like, bopping around this tree. Because I think an XPath is moving around a tree to go some other part of that tree. And we've defined all the ways you could imagine jumping and grabbing. So, technical term, jumping and grabbing, I realize that's complicated, but think of that way. I'm in a tree, I'm going to jump around and grab things. So, I'm going to start with a context node. I'm going to number the tree first, recursively. So here I see a tree that I just made up, and I'm now at node number 5 in this tree. So, you see that I have parents. My parent is node 3. My children are node 6, 7, and 11. My siblings are node 4 and 12 and 13 and so on. So I have these relationships in the tree that I want to use with XPath. So far, so good, right? Okay. So, where's my child? Well, my child is 6, 7, and 11. My attributes are the things wrapped around me in node 5. And my parent is my parent node 3. Likewise, I can say, where are all the nodes that follow me? So, 5 is followed by, in tree syntax, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16. That's the definition of following by. The following siblings says only the ones that are my siblings I want to grab. The preceding is everything that's ahead of me in the tree. The preceding sibling is are the siblings that are ahead of me in the tree. And so on. So we use that kind of, so there's 13 of those, and about half a dozen of them are really, really useful. Even though we often default the child, it's often useful to say, give me the first child of my second sibling, for reasons that you can imagine. A really good example is to say, I want to make sure that the first letter of the first paragraph of the first chapter has got one of those giant capitals in it when I render it, let's say. Okay, in printed books. So you can think of all these different things you could do. You could identify particular parts of a complex tree structure. So what Bure is showing us, like that read pretty easily, didn't it, the Bure reading? You did read Bure. Okay, so Bure is a mountain man. He lives up in Felton, up near Santa Cruz. He essentially works as an XML consultant. And he actually taught XML and database at the iSchool for 2 years, back in about 2005 and 2006. Because he's a friend of mine. I had him down here. He used to drive in one night a week and teach this stuff, but he got too tired of driving down from Santa Cruz. But very mellow dude. See, he writes in a very kind of easy-to-read style. I wish Manning was as easy-to-read as Bure was. So the example, these are examples from the Beray chapter. I'm going to show you essentially what he's saying is how to use XML queries to go into a collection of books and pick out particular types of elements using these XPath things. So here it says, go to this book collection and then find the author. But author is a tag that is starting with that collection. Slash slash means anywhere in that collection. So that's a syntax in XPath to go. And you start with the root and just look anywhere in the document. And we use that a lot. We're saying, find anything in this, starting with the root. But we could also say, starting with some place other than the root, then find its children and things like that. So we're using this to find particular things. So here you see, for example, I want to find in some collection of procedures, go to the place where procedures is the root node now, any steps the procedure contains, and if there's more than 7 steps in the procedure, I want to know, because that's a complicated thing, I want to pull it out separately. So this is, you're looking at the structure of a document to find named parts of it. This is one where he says, I'm going to some kind of chemical procedures book and I want to find all those which, I want to find the required chemicals and I want to pull out the title followed by the list of chemicals in this procedure. The last one's a really interesting one, which I think this is hinted at in an earlier paper, the paper about the American Geophysical Society. Remember the one, the publishing, the XML publishing case study? In complex technical publishing environments, like if you worked for Boeing or if you worked for Enron or Exxon or you work for Bechtel or some other thing that has lots of complicated systems of equipment, often there'll be technical documentation that describes how that equipment's put together. Boats, ships, airplanes, right? And that equipment will be maintained over a useful life of maybe decades. There are ships which have been in the Navy for 50 years, right? 50?
Fifty-year-old
ships in the Coast Guard. They may have a manual how the Coast Guard this ship works. It's that we fixed the engine, we've replaced the engines, and now we have a new engine manual, and so on. Okay, so it may be that each particular instance of an airplane or a ship or whatever it is has its essentially own custom technical manual. So there's people who are writing the documents for these things, and they have specialized procedures for particular tail numbers or particular boat numbers of planes or airplanes. I mean, planes or boats. And this says, I want to find the procedure for some part where it is this particular procedure for this part, for this particular model, but I want to make sure that it's for the period that I'm interested in, because it may be that they're repairing an old plane that this part was only in it for a certain part of the time. So they're using something called effectivity date. They essentially have produced documents that, as of a certain date. Think of the law. We have a regulation passed in 2003. It gets modified 4 times. We go to court about something that comes disputed in 2005. What was the law like in 2005? Unwrap the changes since then and reproduce the original law from 2005. That kind of structure-based effectivity kind of retrieval is pretty important. Now, if we don't have internal structure and we do retrieval, we just retrieve the entire document, right? Just bring the whole document back. What we want to do, of course, is to use that internal structure, so we want to retrieve parts of documents. But an important goal there would be to say, let's find the most specific part of the document that is responsive to our query. So to say, where does the sentence to be or not to be come from? Oh, it comes from Shakespeare. Not all that useful. We'd like to know that it comes from Act 3, Scene 1, Line 56 of Macbeth. That's right, of Hamlet. Okay? So we want to know what granular part of that document are going to be retrieved. So how do we retrieve parts of documents as documents? We have to index them as documents. So you have to break up this big document into pieces. And that's the problem of indexing unit. We saw some of that in Manning, and it's worth talking about for a few minutes. If we want to, it sounds like an easy goal, but it's hard to do. You say, I want to basically index documents in ways that I can retrieve the most useful unit. Okay? But again, we're using the structure tree in the XML. And I want to be able to break it up in ways that make sense. But here you see in that document you have, here you see the kind of the metadata, author title. Here you see chapters. So this is the structure of that XML document. Essentially metadata, chapter, chapter, section, section. If I break it up into say the metadata part and pull that off, so I have book has the following metadata in it, I've now stripped off from this its metadata. Well, but this may be still okay as a good piece, the chapter piece here, it's green. But then I want to do the same thing here. I want to pull off the sort of the top part of the chapter and end up with these, now the subparts. So I end up with sort of good and bad parts, maybe when I try to break things into these smaller pieces. So if I want to have these pseudo documents, which are these sort of smaller things than the whole document, I may have to have some redundancy in the way I break things up, and they can be very, very subtle. Because if I just carve it up into pieces like this with no overlap, then I lose some key contextual information when I retrieve the smaller pieces. There's another problem we have to deal with if we want to have subparts, and that's this one here. What is the problem that this picture poses to us? This went on for two pages in Manning. We have two books. One is the title Microsoft and its office Bill Gates, and one is the Pearly Gates and the office Bill Wolf. We put this in into the collection. And we want to search for Gates. We don't want that. We don't want to get both of those documents in terms of a search for Gates, because we know that in one case, Gates is an author. In the other case, Gates is a part of a title. So, if we want to retrieve parts of documents based on their internal structure, like I want to retrieve Gates in the context of author versus Gates in the context of title, then does it make sense to do things like TF-IDF over the entire document collection? Why not? That would assume that TF-IDF doesn't look at the internal structure, it's just the collection as a whole. Everything in a document for TF and then IDF is the across all the different ones. So it would say, we're not using this information. So we can't use TF-IDF in the simple way. What should we do? Yes, Dan.
He was suggesting splitting each word into a separate token and
searching data. We need to basically compute TF-IDF over the structural units that we want to treat as important in IR. So we have to basically say, what is TF-IDF for the word Gates in the context of book author or book title kind of thing, right? So we have to have TF-IDF computed in the relevant context, so we can't, of course, distinguish it, use it to weight retrieval. So these are, you know, go down to the term level and then index on the basis of position in the XML tree. So you thought TF-IDF was ugly in assignment 7? Do it for every possible structural context. Ooh. Well, how many possible structural contexts are there? How many structures of the document How many subtrees contain at least one of those lexicon items? Well, I take this tree and I want to index Microsoft, Bill, and Gates, but I can index them in all kinds of different ways. Okay? Microsoft is part of the book title. Microsoft is part of a title. You know, Bill Gates is part of author, but Gates is part of author. I mean, what's the relevant structural unit that I'm going to compute T of IDF and index over? Oh my God. We have an exponential jackpot here in terms of possible indexing. So, I mean, do we want to have essentially one axis in the vector space for every single term in every single structural context? There's eight ones for Gates alone there we just saw. So, it gets pretty complicated pretty fast. So you see that while there's potentially a great deal of internal structure we could use, you're going to get what you pay for. Now, and that's on the back office, invisible from the user interface side of this problem. If I have all this internal structure and I want to use it, what's the implication for the user interface?
Well,
I have to be able to ask questions which use the structure. No more just text box type the word. I got to be able to say, I want this word in the following structural context. Well, how do I expose that structural context to the user and the user interface? Think that your grandmother can whip it open an XML query window and make sense of it? I think you could. So here is a really simple example of a kind of XML query front end where on the left side, I'm trying to create my query, and here I'm writing the query. I'm writing essentially code in order to do my query. So it's essentially the same problem we saw here, where I got too many of these guys. I want to find Sylvia. Okay, it's the same problem we had here where Sylvia wants to be able to, you know, let you create this XML instance, but in order to make that possible, you have to have a very complicated UI with a number of different panels. How do I specify, the parts of a reading, or the parts of a, what reading, the relationship of readings to topics? Do I create my list of topics first and then fill in the readings? Do I have my readings and assemble them into topics? You know, what comes first, the topic or the readings? Think of that kind of question as a professor. Do I create a lot of list of readings and say, how do I organize them in topics? Or do I say, what should I talk about, and then find readings that support what I'm talking about? That kind of vision is implied in the UI of an editor for creating syllabi. As it is implied in here, how much of the structure of the play should I expose to the person writing the query so they can write a query that will get at what they want? So let me conclude with the picture you've seen many times so far that says the core problems of information retrieval are finding the documents and ordering them according to relevance. The IRM model, which says how we solve those problems, and again, we start with the same collection. We could treat an XML collection as a bag of words, strip out the markup and toss it on the floor. Be easy. We'd lose a lot of value though. But how much do I want to work to make this problem solvable? It's a trade-off of computational complexity against sort of ease of doing it. So let me go back and just highlight some of the more important slides here. Yeah, we want to use something more than bags of words because that's losing all this information that's implied in the structure of the document, which varies immensely across the spectrum. The problem is that we have this decision to make, especially in the middle where we have hybrid document types. How much of that structure am I willing to encode in my instance? because that requires work. You're telling your authors, whenever you encode this document, make sure you separately mark up these pieces as opposed to just writing me a blob of text. What's in it for them? If you can't make the case that says what benefit they have with their institution that they work for benefits, you'll never get it done. So, we have this, the default rule says, well, we have full text for stuff which has no structure, database things which are highly structured. In the middle, where we have this structure-based retrieval, we make these decisions, and that's where we can decide how to get our stuff into the database. Do we do it in a way which is uses the metadata of the document primarily, or do we push farther down to use the XML structure of it in the document collection? And do we do it in a easy but not very efficient way, or do we do something more interesting but where we have to perhaps constrain our XML models to be flatter, less optionality, or do we use a full XML database where we can use the XML components as first-class citizens? This idea of using the structure of the document with XPath to find queries, write queries that let us use particular parts of the document is really important. But of course, the more we do that, we raise these challenging cases of indexing and new kinds of very complicated vector models. So that's it for today. On Wednesday, we're having a lecture on multimedia search and multimedia and mobile search and retrieval. And you've got three readings, a pretty fast chapter of Marty Hurst, plus a couple of readings that are differentially difficult. The Patrick Schmitz paper reads pretty easily about the Delphi project. The other project, a little more difficult, but you'll see that they're using a combination of text and audio analysis to be able to figure out what similarity between songs means, which is kind of an interesting problem. And with that, I want to stop.